somewhere in the middle of your presentation when the clock ran out on us. So would you?
Thank you.
Pick us up where you want it to be. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. my name is Chip Terhune. I'm the chief of staff to the governor. We left off.
All of the staff, you know, the members who are out there listening to this on the their monitors or their staff heard the comment that you made. So
I just it somehow seemed appropriate.
Well, thank God I'm that one member.
and I would like to say thank you. We left off on page 12. We were about to start off on page 12 of the presentation related to affirmative action. And with me is Peggy Ross, who manages and directs this out of the governor's office. And I'd like to turn it over to her this morning just to kind of give you a little bit of brief background on the affirmative action and, in essence, give you a little history, perhaps, and then also talk about, obviously, the key performance measures. So without further ado.
Morning, Katie.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Peggy C. Ross, the Governor's Director of Affirmative Action. Just a little brief history, a couple of liners. This office was established in 1975 to eliminate the effects of past and present underrepresentation, intended or unintended, that are evident by analysis of present employment patterns, practices, and policies. Now, our objective is to not only to monitor the agency's compliance with this and equal employment opportunity, diversity, internal and external public relations. Also, we are to be a proactive in sharing tools and working with agencies to achieve these objectives. We work toward making the state the employee of choice, and this term is used a lot now, and it refers to a place where people want to work and are comfortable in their working positions. And four ways an organization can become an employee of choice is because it is progressive, that is, in recruitment and non-traditional outreach; two, because it tackles challenges and everyone and overcome obstacles. And they're taking a look at their workplace, what's working and what's not working, and hopefully through the cultural competency assessment, yearly reviews, and exit interviews. Three, because it offers opportunity for career growth. We use the term a lot now, homegrown. That is, that they're trying to grow people within their organizations to be a promotion within. And the fourth is because employees feel good about working here. The physical and the mental environment is both welcoming and safe. Some of the things that we continue to do is that we started 3.5 years ago monthly affirmative action work groups. This is where we've invited the affirmative action representatives from all the agencies to meet once a month for 2 hours. And what we do there, we have the agencies to share their successes and their missteps, how to overcome those, and sharing so we don't have to reinvent the wheel what's working. We also have speakers from various areas talking about diversity, what's working in other corporations and in other government agencies, and what is going on in the United States and abroad. We also are there to build strong relationships and to encourage employment with the state and to join state boards and commissions by attending different events, especially attending the ethnic chambers meetings such as the Native American, the Hispanic, the Filipino chambers, and attending a community celebrations where often we read proclamations or letters from the governor, like the Vietnamese Tet, Chinese New Year, Bangladesh community's new events, Haitian recognition, and faith-based celebrations. We also attend the Salem Rights Committee meetings to be aware of events that are going on here. So that gives you a little background of what we're doing and trying to do.
Do you want to talk at all about the performance measures? So moving to slide 11, really kind of focusing now on the performance measures that we've got. These are also in development, just like the ones we talked about yesterday in MWESB. And so basically what we'd like to kind of walk you through is just very briefly on this slide is slide 12, I apologize. that it's the employer of choice and the definition of employer of choice that I think is really kind of the key component here. And it's how we measure whether or not Oregon is succeeding in achieving that goal. And I think that's been really the challenge, frankly, in sort of arriving at a performance measure for this. That is such a huge sort of all-encompassing term.
Representative Crummell.
I was going to say, would that be criminal? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was trying to get my hearing going here at the same time.
Multitasking.
Multitasking.
Yes.
I'm not good at multitasking.
Chip,
lucky if I can do one.
Chip, excuse me for interrupting you, but when we say employer of choice, who are we talking about? The employer of choice. Are we talking about the state of Oregon being
the
employer of choice? Do we really want the state? I mean, we want good people coming to work for us, but do we want the state being the employer of choice, or wouldn't it be better to have somebody in the private sector being the employer of choice?
I can answer.
I mean, we're already the largest employer in the state, so.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Como, what we're saying, employer of choice, yeah, we want the state to be the employer of choice. We want the people that are here to be recognized and want to stay. We don't want the turnovers that we've been having. And yes, our corporations are also employers of choice. But we want each agency to represent and become a whole as a state as the employee of choice.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
In other words, we want the governor's office to be an employer of choice.
And all of the agencies.
Yeah, but we're right now, we're on the governor's office.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. However, the statutory obligation of affirmative action out of this is for all of the executive branch as well.
Right, I understand that, sir. It was going to lead to a question that I'm going to want to have information on is, what is the diversity within the governor's office itself? Are we able to lead the other agencies in carrying out the mandates of the affirmative action and equality of opportunity, and I'm sure you're going to get there. So, but I do understand what you're, Senator Johnson.
I'm just trying to understand how you can have a performance measure that holds you accountable for stuff that you can't control, and I think it's a pointless measure, if you'll forgive me. We are an employer of choice because we have good pay, because we have good benefits, because we have clear mission in our agencies, because we have a welcoming environment for diversity. But you can't control all but just a small piece of that. And I think to hold yourself accountable for things that are well beyond your control, maybe I'm missing something here. Help me get it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, thank you for that. There is no question that it is a worthy goal, and I think an important goal, to try and achieve that status of employer of choice, whether you're in the public sector or, frankly, the private sector, as Representative Crummell pointed out earlier. Having said that, there are many factors, some of which we'll talk about later in this presentation, that are exactly correct, that make that a tremendous challenge. However, it doesn't stop us from continuing to try and work on it. As a performance measure, it is exceptionally difficult to wrap our arms around this.
I might just make this observation, Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind. I toiled in the bowels of ODOT for 5 years, and that experience was extremely instructive to me in terms of the vast gap between people who serve and people who are served. And I could very easily understand some kind of a measure, and I can't make it up right now because I'm just not smart enough at 8:45 in the morning, but some kind of a measure that elevated the service of the public employees so that it was recognized as a valuable contribution to making the state work. I was really quite surprised about public attitudes towards public employees. And to the degree that it speaks to customer service, that cadre of people who work for the state make a valuable and honored contribution to the success of Oregon is something that I would hope that the performance measure would speak to. But I just think that you ought to be held accountable to things that you can directly influence. And while you may play a small role in having the chief executive officer of the state's behavior and tone in office and corporate culture, for lack of a better word, set a certain standard, I would be quite concerned about holding yourself accountable for stuff you can't control. I'm thinking right now, for example, of the arguments around the ability to recruit and retain judges and the sort of collective disinvestment that the legislature has made in the judicial branch. If I worked anywhere in the judicial branch, a judge, a DA, anybody, I would feel pretty undervalued, and I would worry about the public perception of the deterioration of a third branch of government. So I think that the goal is lofty in that you want to try to present a workforce to the people that they serve and to the nation as a highly skilled, diverse, reflective of the population of Oregon workforce, but I just don't know if that performance measure gets there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, really the only two measures that we have right now that we can actually get our hands on really are the last two bullet points on slide 12. Tracking data on the protected classes being hired, promoted, and retained on a quarterly basis, and then obviously tracking patterns from exit interviews so we understand why people are leaving as an employer of choice. I think that's also very, very important information to gather. We're hoping that from those data streams, we will be able to sort of make an analysis and figure out exactly how to improve things that need to be improved.
Mr. Chair, one more thing. Excuse me. This presentation this morning and the fact that you spoke of the affirmative action officers and all of the other agencies is just one more step in reinforcing my belief that we have to elevate the conversation about women, minorities, emerging business, and not in that grouping necessarily together, because I think that grouping means one thing, but that we have to group the discussion about minorities and women in some other place. I haven't fully formed my opinion yet, but I'm almost moving in the direction of saying that there ought to be I stop short of saying an agency because I can feel people recoil in the creation of another agency, but some place to gather all of these pockets of initiative around the issues of minorities, women, and small business in a really meaningful way, and not just these sort of, like you take a paintbrush and spatter it against the wall, there's a little dot here and a little dot there. If we're serious about having a conversation, it ought to be elevated to a level that that it's visible. And I understand that there are drawbacks to mixing those functions that are regulatory or carry a certification charge, those that are customer service and ombuds have a ombuds-like character to what they do. There are those that are advocates. There are those that are troubleshooters. I think they could all be housed somewhere so that the citizens of Oregon could find assistance in a much more visible place than just these little stabs at trying to get our arms around making sure that our workforce is reflective of our state. I have this mounting dissatisfaction with the way that we're dealing with the issue of minorities in this state.
Senator Johnson, it strikes me that the operant phrase in your statement was, if we're serious.
Yeah. I feel a task force moving in me, an interim task force. You know, nothing solves a problem like a good old task force. But
two in one week
is a 2 week task force. Or two task force weeks. But I really mean if we're serious. We give a pittance to the advocacy commissions and then we beat them up for not performing. We have pockets of this activity in every agency. And they have meetings, and I'm very respectful of what you said today and what Lydia said yesterday, but I'm not sure the public realizes a value out of that comparison of agency to agency dealing with affirmative action. If we are serious, I'd like to see a portal of entry for minority contractors. I'd like to see a portal of entry for dealing with Ombudsman's issues. A clear, articulated portal of entry. And I just don't feel like that exists now. And maybe I'm the only guy wandering out in the woods feeling this way, but it sure seems as though we've sat in these two rooms all this session and heard about little stabs of dealing with this issue scattered all over state government and nothing comprehensive, nothing visible, nothing really funded, no go-to-ground place where if I were a female African-American entrepreneur, I know that's the place I need to go to get help. And the idea that exists at OECDD that there is no closed door, so that if I came into some highly visible place that managed this activity on behalf of the state, that I would know that there would be people there that could sift me out to wherever I needed to go. Maybe I have a certification problem. Maybe I have whatever. But that there would be no closed door in this centralized repository of women, minorities, and emerging business.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on a couple of things. With regarding to finding assistance, of course, as representatives and senators, one of the main things that we get are when people have complaints because they've attempted to get assistance.
Sure.
And then find out that they can't get assistance and don't really get the answers that they want. With regard to value add, I think that's one of the big questions. And if we as legislators don't see value in something, the best thing we could do would be to cut it loose and put the resources somewhere else, as opposed to continuing with these pittances of dollars here and there that don't really amount to a hill of beans. But I wanted to ask with regards to the measurement that you're talking about, Chip. Becoming the employer of choice and everything. So what is, and then you referred to the two measures down below. Those to me are outputs.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't outcomes.
Correct.
Those are outputs. And so what? So we track the data. Big deal. Who cares? What difference does it make? So the question becomes, what's so on this becoming employer of choice, what's the outcome that's expected?
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at these measurements that you're going to track this data, hey, that's great, track the data, but what's the outcome that we expect? What are we going to do with that data once we have it? What's the outcome that we're going to get? Is it we're going to find that, you know, what Senator Johnson is talking about, that we need to have this single repository where people can go to get information? Is it going to be a restructuring so that the information can get out, so that when they do look in the yellow pages or they do look at ads and that sort of thing? When I first came to this building, one of the questions that I asked health services people a lot, every agency, every part of it that came before us, was, how do I find you?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that becomes kind of a critical point here. So the big question on your performance, and I realize it's hard to get your hands around it, but to really break it down into what's the outcome that's expected, what are you going to do with the data, what does it mean? Because if you're just tracking the data, so what? I mean, hell, we can have a chimpanzee sitting in front of a computer screen tracking data, and they may not be able to regurgitate to us what it says, but at least they're tracking it.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, you're exactly right in terms of the way you break this slide down. The bottom two bullets are indeed outputs as opposed to outcomes that we are seeking. We are hoping that the information gathered therein leads to outcomes that we can then sort of validate or verify down the road. Having said that, the dilemma that you just outlined is, I think, exactly why this measure is still in development. This is an extremely complex thing by which to get our arms around and try and figure out, what does it mean to be an employer of choice? What is the outcome that we're seeking to have? Is it a high level of attraction of you know, diverse and highly qualified skilled workers? Is it a retention issue? Is it both? Is it somewhere in between? And those are all, I think, really, really important issues. It's also a measurement of some things, frankly. The goal would be to measure some things that are very difficult to measure in and of itself, which is, how do people feel in the workplace? Do they feel welcome? Do they feel embraced? Do they feel like their needs are being addressed? And those are real challenges that we're struggling with, frankly, on this particular measurement. Peggy, I don't know if you have something you want to add on that. Okay. What I'd like to do now, thank you, Peggy, is turn to...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that you were done with this. Can I ask one more question on that?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another one of the things that's on the slide here is encourage participation with cultural competency assessment. You know, over the past few years, we've been hearing a lot about cultural competency. Is that translated into political correctness? And if it is, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't go there. So help me understand what cultural competency is.
On this cultural competency, what we did was we did identify through an RFP two consultants, ISAC consultants, to come in and to evaluate what is going on in the agencies. Cultural competency is defined out, it's just a broad term. It could be maybe even verified as cultural awareness. But what it would do is that go into the agencies and find out what is going on in the agencies. Why is there, after we identify through those measurements, why is there a high turnover in some agencies than others? Why aren't they able to retain? What is the recruitment that's going on? Why is the environment maybe not welcoming? Or why do people feel that they're not being heard? So all of this is done through the assessment. It's of questions that are asked and to weed out what's going on in those in there. After the assessments are done, then maybe it's the policies that's not understood, or maybe it's training that is needed on cultural awareness. It's not a political correctness term.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, you sort of changed nomenclature on me a little bit when you said cultural competency and then cultural awareness. I mean, you know, I can go to the ballet and enjoy that, and that I would think that, you know, or I can go to movies, or I can go to, you know, I mean, I try to treat people around me with respect, and, you know, all of that. So I would consider myself to be, I guess, a culturally competent or culturally aware person, but I'm trying to get at what, and I guess it goes back to what's the outcome. But what do we mean when we say if somebody in a fit of anger makes a derogatory remark to somebody, or that person takes it as derogatory, does that mean that they are not culturally competent and they need rehab? You know, I'm really trying to understand what it means, and I apologize, but You're not getting me there yet.
Okay. What it is, again, cultural competence is to make you aware that even when you make a remark, as you said, a derogatory remark, maybe to me it wouldn't be derogatory, but maybe to someone else it would, is to make sure that you are aware of what you said that maybe was that stepped on my toe, but maybe not on the next person's toe. It's bringing people around a table to discuss things and open up on things that maybe you hadn't asked before, or maybe you're concerned about, or maybe you have said, or you have felt. So it's bringing all those things out as far as the cultural awareness part. Is that a little clearer?
Somewhat. Yeah. And, you know, rather than spending a lot of the time here, Mr. Chair, maybe I just need to do my own research, but I really am having a hard time with that as a...
If it'll help, Representative. The drawing on a little bit of professional background and the term culture, one, you know, in any introductory anthropology or sociology, even in some psychology texts, will have big stabs at defining culture. One anthropologist wanted to, whose name now escapes me, but I could dig it up if you're really interested, wanted to define culture, spent 300 plus pages in a textbook defining culture, and the concluding paragraph was that the subject was too big for the amount of time he had to put into it. So I can understand very well, you know, where you come from. And I think in relationship to this, we probably all share some of that feeling, and some of us are somewhat willing to be maybe complacent with our definition of it and proceed, you know, along that line. But maybe as we branch out a little bit, we do discover new definitions and new concepts, new ideas, you know, with it. I think the biggest virtue, if I can say that, is your awareness that there are some definitions here that you really don't have a good grasp for, and your search for, and I'm sure continued search for it, those explanations. And I may be going where you didn't want to go with that. But
could I add one thing, Mr. Chair?
But of course.
It won't be 300 pages long on the definition of culture.
That's okay.
But one of the ways that we've defined culture a lot, and my experience is the way we do things around here. So in each one of your organizations, or each one of your families, it's the way you do things can be defined as culture. Does that help?
Thank you.
Thank you, Peggy. Okay, moving to slide 13. We've now sort of completed a discussion of the statutorily required elements of the governor's office, and I think, you know, this slide is really intended to sort of talk about the future direction and some of the key pieces of that. We've listed just five priorities of the governor's agenda. Having said that, it was hard to take the list of 100 and reduce it to five, but we tried. There are others. But education, and really, again, that education enterprise, the from preschool all the way through graduate school, I think is a real top priority for the governor. Healthy kids and making sure that every child in Oregon has health insurance is another one. The issue of energy independence and renewables, I think, continues to be a top priority for the governor. Clearly efficient and effective state government is a constant. And then also diversifying, broadening executive appointments. And people may find that as sort of an interesting insert there. But with 200 boards and commissions, we have, I think, a constant challenge to try and get Oregon citizens engaged and involved in that process. There are many times when I think the more high-profile boards and commissions certainly have innumerable applicants, but there are an awful lot of very, very important smaller-profile levels of engagement where applicants are frankly hard to come by. And some of that relates to maybe a matter of expertise in a particular issue area. But I think a lot of it is the fact that we need to do a better job of outreach and trying to get folks engaged. And that's something that we're working diligently on.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
If I might, I'd like to comment. Yesterday on the Senate floor, we took action on a slate of executive appointments, and I have the privilege of serving on rules, which looks at these. I would like to commend Nancy Goss-Duran in the governor's office for the work she's doing. Two that stick out in my mind from yesterday are Dr. Budden, who works at OHSU, and another Dr. Neese, who is, among other things, a flight surgeon for the space shuttle program at NASA. I was just dazzled with these resumes, and we interviewed both of the candidates. Neither one of them came in because Dr. Neese was bidding his son off to Iraq, and Dr. Budden had such a full clinical schedule. But these were simply dazzling applicants. And the state is well served on a board as complex and serious in nature as the Board of Medical Examiner to have these two individuals. So I'm just using them as illustrative. Dr. Budden's published articles and learned papers went on for 9 pages. They're just, you'll have a chance on the House side to see them when the appointments come over, but they were just, or, no, you won't. Sorry.
No.
They were just,
good to hear about them.
Yeah. They were just dazzling.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is true. Nancy Gastrand does an amazing job, and it is phenomenal the kind of people that we have in the state. There is some incredible talent, and I think the term hidden jewels comes out more often than not as we sort of move through applications. Having said that, we're always looking for more jewels, and they're out there, and we need to do a better job of getting them.
These were stunning.
The next portion of this is also we feel like the coordination between federal, state, and local is another area that needs to sort of have heightened focus on as it relates to the governor's office and moving forward from this point on. You know, clearly dependence upon federal funding streams and a host of other issues sort of create a new sense of urgency, if you will, around a lot of these relationships. I think local governments are struggling with increasing and new challenges on a regular basis, and our ability to make sure that we understand what those challenges look like and make sure that if we can take action before they become crises and that we can assist them in fashions to, from a state-level perspective, we want to make sure we're on top of that as well. So that's another area that we're very, very focused on. In terms of agency and agency-to-agency coordination, that's another area. If you look at alcohol and drug treatment, for example, as an issue area, you know, you can tick off a handful of agencies fairly quickly that all have programs that are invested in that, whether it's Department of Ed, Department of Corrections, DHS. And it's important that all of those agencies have a table that they can sit down at and talk about on those specific issue areas to try and come up with policies that work. So that duplication doesn't happen. I mean, they're just kind of the coordination aspect of what we do inside the governor's office is immense, frankly. And then last one, of course, partnering with private organizations. That's something that we constantly seek to do because we think we can learn tremendously valuable things from private organizations and adapt accordingly. Moving to page 14. Budget drivers and issues. The first three bullets there are really variables that impact the governor's budget. Obviously, the governor's agenda. The fact that we were able to take 100 bullet points and reduce them to 5 helps. We also have statutorily required duties that we perform, which we've gone through both today and yesterday with you. Those obviously impact the budget. And then economic changes. I mean, clearly, when recessions hit and budgets get cut, the governor's budget is amongst them. That's straightforward. Technology is a big issue in our budget, and again, want to compliment all of you and LFO for helping us in a lot of that, including the supplemental budget request that's currently in the works. And then staffing level, clearly a critical component that will impact the budget. And then finally, travel. Travel is expensive, and it is constant. This is a big state in many respects. So just putting those on the list there.
I very much appreciate the travel issue and the size of the state and the lack of awareness of the geography of the state on the part of a lot of people. I know there are people here who, in this building, who still don't believe that it's the same number of miles from Salem to Pendleton as it is from Pendleton to Salem. And I've checked this now since I've been in the legislature dozens of times, and my odometer comes out the same. I can't believe it, you know. But it does strike me that we all, and this is not just the governor's office, but we all are guilty of wasting a lot of time and resources in some of the travel we do when we are at a point of having the technology that will put us in a face-to-face interaction even though we're 300 miles apart, or for that matter, 3,000 miles apart. I would like to see us, I think, try to move more in that direction, and I personally as guilty as anybody else on this, but it's just a challenge that we have to try to cut that down. And the biggest cost, and I see Representative Byers got a question or a rebuttal of one or the other coming here. The biggest cost of the travel thing is not necessarily the amount of you know, money that it costs in either per diem or mileage or airplane sort of thing, as it is the amount of time that one has to take away from, you know, their central core of what they're doing. I mean, that seat time, which at its best is not as productive as it might be if you were sitting in some other place. Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's half and half, I guess. I tend to agree that there are so many new technologies out there that we could be taking advantage of, and doing meetings and that type of thing. But I do think that there is no replacement for having the governor out in the state and visiting different communities. I mean, I just don't think it's anywhere near the same thing. And as much as we can do that, I think it's I think the communities love to have him there, love to show their communities off. I just think that's something that we have to acknowledge, is that it wouldn't be the same if you had him on a webcast or something as having him in your community.
Representative, I don't have a quarrel with that, and I think this governor has had the very unpleasant and unfortunate task of attending the funerals of all of the young men and women who have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, sort of thing. And you know, his picture on some sort of a screen or what have you is not going to be the same thing and not have the same meaning as its you know, actual presence there. And I think that's true in a number of places where. And I think it was true, you know, in some ways for the Ways and Means Committee as we make these trips around the state. By the same token, for an individual to, you know, have a physician at OHSU has all of the capability of, you know, providing expert advice to a patient in Pendleton, Oregon by not leaving the facility, it's senseless for them to spend the time, forget about the cost of the airplane, the time on an airplane flying to Pendleton and flying back. I mean,
I agree.
And all of that can be carried out. So, and I'm not making that as a criticism as much as it is, you know, to be on that we need to work more with the technology that we have available to minimize the costs of government, if you please.
Well, and Mr. Chair, again, the technology, I think, within the governor's office is due to improve. Right now, I don't think we do have the ability to really sort of replace that outreach that is done by travel. But having said that, I also duly note Representative Byers' point that there is no substitute for FaceTime, and I think that visiting communities is an opportunity for the governor really to also something that he just takes a tremendous amount of information back here and is able to then incorporate that into the formation of public policy, which I think is valuable for everyone. So. Moving to slide 15, which is just ever so briefly the budget overview. on the in the middle column, we have the legislatively approved budget for 2005-07. Then we have the governor's recommended budget, 07-09, sort of line by line here with the general fund dollar amounts, lottery funds, other funds, federal funds, and then the total funds with FTE at the bottom. So that's just a sort of point of reference for you.
Sure. Thank you. Chip, a couple of things. What federal funds, why do we get federal funds to operate the governor's office? Why did we in 05, 07, but we're not.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with Budget and Management Division. Right now, the governor's office, the Office of Rural Policy, has a grant from the federal government to do part of their work on developing priorities in rural policy issues. They also had a small grant in the 0305 biennium. And at least when they got this last grant this last year, that particular grant, the federal government said this is the last extension of that grant.
Thank you. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Chip, I noticed that the budget that's being proposed here is about 30% over what was legislatively adopted or approved in for 0507. Are you going to go into some detail about why we're looking at a 30% increase in the governor's budget?
Well, as a matter of fact, that I think is forthcoming after the next several slides. So the answer is yes. Good question.
Then I'll hold my powder, Mr. Chair.
Actually, if we look at general funds, it gets closer to 40% than to 30%. Probably.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Page 16 is yet another view of the budget expenditures by fund type in this case. So again, you've got the total budget in the upper left-hand corner, the general fund at 79% with each of those areas sort of broken down. Included in the federal office, I do want to point out that the National Governors Association dues are also included in that portion of that number, so that's why that's a little higher. Other funds at 8%, and then the lottery funds at 13% there. On page 17, similar except this time by program area, so 65% of the governor's office budget going to policy and administration, 6% to arrest and return, affirmative action at 4%, the ERTS at 13%, Office of Rural Policy at 3%, Minority Women and Emerging Small Business at 4%, and then the federal office at 5%, which again includes the National Governors Association dues there, that figure. And now we get to the portion that I think gets to Representative Crummell's earlier question, which is why the increase, and start with the federal office in terms of request. Oregon had a federal affairs office in the governor's housed in the governor's office up until the budget cuts that occurred in 2002-2003. It was in May of 2006 returned back to the governor's office. And what I'd like to do is just talk a little about the value that it brings, not just in terms of the coordination aspects of this, but some concrete examples about where the Federal Affairs Office has really delivered, I think, already, even just, you know, we haven't been back in operation for even less than a year. The first example I'll use is county payments, the issue of payments in lieu of taxes that Congress is clearly in the midst of grappling with. If you recall back in December, it was not on the congressional radar screen. I think that's a safe statement. The issue of county payments, despite the fact that it's $500 million to the state of Oregon in a biennium, just wasn't a priority in Congress. The Federal Affairs Office basically rolled up the sleeves and went to work, and they went to work in a variety of fashions to get this going. The first thing they did was launched into the National Governors Association to make this not just an Oregon issue, not just a Western states issue, but a national issue, a priority. In addition to that, we worked very, very hard with not just the Oregon delegation, but indeed the chairs of the committees in Congress and also leadership in Congress to really try and heighten and elevate this issue to make sure that folks understood not just the impact to Oregon, but the impact to every state that, that frankly, is a recipient of these funds. The initial reaction that we were getting was, dream on. I think that's probably a fair assessment of where folks were initially. But it didn't stop us. The Federal Affairs Office took the lead in being a liaison between the counties in Oregon and their voice in Congress, made sure that each of the congressional delegation actually had specific information about how this was going to impact the state. And as those impacts became better known, this issue of county payments became elevated to a point where despite sort of the current threat of a veto because of the bill it was tucked into, the House and the Senate do have county payments now as a priority, do have it as an issue, and we feel like a resolution that's favorable to Oregon is a very likely outcome. This is a huge difference from where we were in December, and I'm very, very pleased to say that the federal office didn't just play a role, it played a pivotal role in making that happen. So that's one. Another example recently is veterans housing. In 1986, I mean, obviously Oregon makes low-interest loans, housing loans to veterans. In 1986, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decided that it wanted to cut costs and capped the rate at which Oregon could basically create those loans. They did it for five states. I believe they were Oregon, Texas, Alaska, Wisconsin, and California. Oregon is for some time, actually all five states have been for some time seeking to get that cap lifted so that more housing can be provided to veterans and allow for increased flexibility. A few weeks ago, California and Texas got together and came up with a package that worked very, very well for those two particular states, but didn't do a darn thing for Oregon. Our Federal Affairs Office noted this, went into action, started working with those two states, started working with our congressional delegation, and we now have a bill that is, quite frankly, much better for Oregon in the process. So it's another example of when you have boots on the ground in Congress, you can really start leveraging a lot of good work. And I think that, quite frankly, I'm not sure how we did business between the time period when we cut this and the time period we brought it back. But one of the constant comments that we've gotten back from the congressional office is we now have clarity on what the priorities of the state are. We understand what the need for appropriations are. Because otherwise, if you're sitting in Congress, you just get a proliferation of appropriations requests from agencies. There's no real clear what's the top priority, what's the second priority, what should I be working on? And I think this office not only amplifies those requests, but assists them. Another area where they're going to work is OWIN, Oregon's Wireless Interoperability Network. This is a huge dollar figure. And grappling with homeland security at a federal agency level is not an easy task. But quite frankly, that's what this office does. This office not only works to see that for example, the funding formula will work to benefit Oregon, but frankly, we're in competition with 49 other states for all these dollars. And it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we have the best chance possible to leverage as many dollars as possible.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Trahan, I'm a huge advocate for having an Oregon presence in Washington. I subscribe to the theory that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, and whether we like it or not, that's the way the game is played, and we need to have a physical presence there. My question, first question to you with the chair's indulgence is, what other agencies have a physical presence in Washington? Because at one time when I made reference to working at ODOT had a government affairs person under contract. do you know in what other agencies there resides a presence in D.C.?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I can't give you a specific count, but I can tell you that there are many agencies, from the Department of Education to ODOT to the Department of Human Services. There are many agencies that actually have either a lobbyist there on the ground or a federal affairs officer.
My point, Mr. Chair, is apropos the discussion about affirmative action. Once again, we have pockets of this activity scattered throughout state government, it sounds like. And I wouldn't mind taking a comprehensive look at that and then having an Oregon office doing government affairs. I'd be perfectly happy to have it run out of the governor's office. But something that some amalgamation of effort that was a central point so that they talk to each other, and I'm not reassured that the ODOT person talks to the ODF&W person, talks to the education person. And if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair, I want to go off on one of my other favorite subjects right now, and that is the fact that I don't think we're adequately providing the tools to both our federal delegation and those people that are in our employ. And I go back to my old saw about this needs and issues list. Once upon a time, there was a disciplined, thoughtful list, priced, that had gone through a public process that existed at the county level, that was in some cases given the imprimatur of the county commissioners that says this truly reflects our priorities. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've gotten a call from one of the federal delegation, Senator Smith or Senator Wyden's staff, that says somehow miraculously we found an extra, I'm making these numbers up, $2 million in a rail account. Do you have a list that reflects a price discipline publicly okie-dokied rail project? And I have to say no. So I think spending this money on having government affairs folks representing the state and asking them to tie one hand behind their back because we haven't provided them with the raw data of what we need is irresponsible. And I don't know what has to happen to get those lists pulled together. Frankly, I'm becoming an advocate of having the rural and regional operations, because they spread out all over the state, do that work. I know the Office of Rural Policy is doing it, but I have a burning sense of urgency about getting this list done. I don't think we have time to study it and think about it, and I just don't know how tough it is to put it together. But certainly, if I had the privilege of representing this state in Congress or in the United States Senate, I would want the message from home about what are the priorities. And so my request is really twofold. I'd like to know what government affairs activities the state of Oregon has scattered throughout state government, and whether or not we would have a more forceful presence in a single amalgamated office that represented the state of Oregon, so it was clear to the delegation and the staffers who was on deck for Oregon, and that we had some fighting chance of having a degree of coordination between those folks to make sure that we got the most bang for the buck. After we got our cloutectomy when Senator Hatfield left, we've had to work extra hard to make sure that Oregon's needs and issues are heard. And I think giving the people that we employ to do that, and I'm sure it's at not inconsequential expense, we ought to give them the best tools that we can to advocate for on-the-ground stuff here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, frankly, the governor couldn't agree with you more in terms of coordination. Every request that comes from every agency in the state of Oregon has to now come through this office. And it's not that this office has veto power over what an agency needs or doesn't need. Those agencies know their needs best. But it can help amplify, and it can help coordinate, and it can help clarify to the congressional delegation and to Congress itself what are the priorities of the state.
I just want to make sure that we've got a concentrated, laser-like effort so that Oregon doesn't look like a box of mice we tipped over. We've got lobbyists employed by the agencies running all over D.C. I would like this to be a really serious initiative, adequately funded, adequately coordinated, and provided with the tools necessary to make sure that Scappoose's issues somewhere come to the fore.
That's right.
And I think we could cut down on a great deal of expense if we invested appropriately in getting very high-quality people to do this work for us at a single point. Mm-hmm. And after this, I'll step out in the hall and get a rabies shot. But I feel so strongly about this.
Dr. Whitsitt, could you take care of that?
Yeah, you're uniquely skilled to help.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's too late.
The symptoms are already showing.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. That's going to be a tough one to follow. But I'm going to try. Okay. Chip, can you tell us what other states are doing in terms of along the lines of what Senator Johnson has been alluding to?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, there are 35 other states that actually have federal affairs offices in the governor's office representing the state in D.C. So there are boots on the ground among 35 other states, and I would guess that the other 15 states that don't are likely, as Senator Johnson said, on the menu as opposed to at the table.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. In regards to that, is one of the and now I'm going to make an assumption here, and my assumption is that since you're the chief of staff of the governor, that you also oversee the D.C. office. Not necessarily. I know you have a director there, but that you oversee the operations there. So, is there a coordination between the governor's office or this office, the federal office, and the counties? I've got two counties that my district covers, and I'm forever getting information from both county commissions about, you know, trips that they've made to D.C. to push this project or that project or to try to bring dollars for this or that and the other. And so is there a coordination there so that when the counties go back, they've been in contact with this federal office, and the federal office is helping them get appointments set up with whoever they need to see and all of those sorts of things?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krummel, excellent question, and the answer is yes. The Federal Affairs Office coordinates directly with the intergovernmental office within the governor's office. There is a tremendous amount of communication traffic between RANAF and the federal office that links, exactly as you just described, counties and local needs with the federal office so that we can give them voice, give them direction, and give them assistance. And the county payments issue is a great example of how that coordination really does work. When the counties made their voice heard to Congress and the impacts became clear to the delegation and to other states' delegations, it really did help turn the tide. And it was that coordination that I think made the difference, frankly. So, yes, the answer is yes.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, and also with the, I heard you mention local, so also with the cities.
Yes.
So, for example, the mayor of the city that I live in was back in D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and they're, to get the most bang out of it, so to speak, there was probably a coordination between the governor's office and her in terms of that visit, or between the federal office and her visit. I mean, that you may not know specifically that case, but I'm just using that as an example.
Right.
And if there wasn't, there should have been.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, clearly we're not aware of every case where local government will go to D.C., but quite frankly, again, through the great work of the Economic Revitalization Team, through the Intergovernmental Office staffed by RANAF, we have actually a very high level of awareness of when folks do need assistance at the federal level. And now that the federal office is in place, we have an opportunity to really link them up and I think try and do that as much as possible. So word is, I think, beginning to get out that it's back. It's here to work for you and with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. moving... Yep,
before Mr. Trehune moves on, I notice that we have a distinguished visitor with us, and and sat at these DSs for a long time, giving guidance and wisdom to the state of Oregon.
Yes, we are delighted to have former senator and former superintendent of public instruction, I think, in the state of Oregon, and a very good friend, and a very good friend of my former president at Blue Mountain Community College. So happy to have you here. And we understand that he has brought some folks to, and let's put the monkey on the senator and representatives back a little bit here. He's brought some friends here with him to show them a little bit. They wanted to know something about the process and about how government works. You know, with that, maybe...
the behavior in the committee will straighten up.
I don't know if that'll happen, but... And if he believes that will happen, he didn't spend enough time here. it is delightful. And thank you, Senator Johnson. We appreciate that.
Moving to page 19, package 101 is actually, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, may I pose one more query to Mr. Chair? Who presently holds the contract for the government affairs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is actually an employee. It is a full FTE. It is Sarah Bittleman, okay, who is the staff person.
And that's what I wanted to understand, whether or not you have done any any analysis about whether or not having an employee versus a contract firm, the cost-benefit ratio, whether or not that's been explored. Again, I want to underscore how supportive I am about having a presence, but I just didn't know the thinking that went into having an employee versus a contract firm.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, although the reestablishment of the Federal Affairs Office was prior to my arrival and my tenure, I understand it was a very strong desire on the part of the governor to have this as an FTE, have this in-house, in large part because it allowed for sort of full focus and singular focus as opposed to juggling multiple issues. And there are enough multiple issues to deal with even just as an FTE, much less as a consultant. So.
And, Mr. Chair, before we leave this, during my rant, I don't know whether or not I was specifically focused to ask whether or not we could have either the professional staff or the governor's office, because they might be uniquely positioned to know what other agencies have representation and whether those are employees or contract government affairs folks.
We'll find out.
Great. Thank you.
Chair,
thank you, Chair Jensen. Chip, what percentage of your all funds budget is personal services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, let me find out for you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't have the numbers actually for the governor's 07-09 budget, but I was looking yesterday at a chart from the 05-07 budget, and it was the personal services are about 75%. And that tends to be pretty constant. I'll do the calculation here and give that to you, but I would expect it stayed right around there for the 07-09.
Thank you.
Moving to page 19, package 101 is, again, fairly straightforward. These are association dues, specifically. The first, the National Governors Association, is the rough equivalent of the National Conference of State Legislatures for a gubernatorial function. The Western Governors Association is similar in some respects, but not certainly doesn't overlap. It's sort of a fundamental belief there that the Western governors have slightly different needs and perspectives, particularly around natural resource issues, than the National Governors Association. So that's a place where natural resource issues get elevated to a much, much higher level. And that association is extremely active on those issues at a federal level. Again, these are the dues were eliminated during the 01-03 alongside the federal office. This is a request to reinstate those dues. And again, I think sort of talks a little about the need to coordinate at the federal level, and both the tools of the WGA and the NGA have proven exceptionally valuable to our federal office and to the state of Oregon as we've tried to move issues up the chain of command and elevate them to get success at the federal level.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Chip, does the travel budget, and I know you'll get there in a minute, but does the travel budget include the governor's and his entourage being able to attend the national governor's conferences when they're held, and also the Western governor's conferences when they're held?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, we attempt to include that in the travel budget, yes. I would also say that there have been times when we have not attended, in part due to budgetary concerns.
Thank you.
Page 20, Package 102, Office of Rural Policy. Jim? I asked Jim to join us here. The Office of Rural Policy was created in 2004, if I'm not mistaken, on the heels of Senate Bill 448 in 2003 session, which was sponsored by Senator Farioli and some others, that was really seeking to coalesce and create a clearinghouse of information for rural needs. That there was, I think, a feeling that there was a dearth of information out there, that it was very difficult to get a hold of, and very, very diverse in the way it came in. And there was an effort to create a central repository where not only rural leaders could sort of come in and say, this is important to us, these are what our priorities are, but also allowed us the opportunity to then do outreach back to them and sort of investigate further what those priorities might be, what they might look like, and then potentially develop some policy applications around them. There's also a huge agency coordination effort that the Office of Rural Policy does. There are 24 state agencies that have liaisons whose job it is, when they report to the Office of Rural Policy, to really look at, through the lens of rural communities, what impact their agencies are having and what they're hearing from their agencies at the rural level. So this is really almost a fact-finding clearinghouse, if you will, of data. So to give you sort of a fuller description and to answer any questions, Jim?
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. As Chip was saying, for the record, I'm Jim Osimov, the director of the Office of Rural Policy in the Governor's Office, and in your organization chart, I'm in the unit under Deputy Chief of Staff Alan Alley, which has much to do with economic development, and I work with the ERT team and Ray Neff and Tim McCabe, economic development advisor to the governor. In addition to the remarks by Chip, Rural Policy was established by Executive Order 0404, and it's also been extended by the governor's executive order this year, 0702. And in the relationship with the ERT team, to help you distinguish between the functions, as noted in the hearing yesterday, the Economic Revitalization Team was established in the Office of the Governor in 2003, and their mission is to coordinate state assistance, resources, and activities to ensure Oregon's readiness for economic development. The ERT team provides coordinated state assistance to local government and businesses on high-priority economic and community development projects and statewide initiatives. While the Office of Rural Policy sometimes coordinates with ERT on specific initiatives or refers situations to their consideration, which may be of a project nature, the Rural Policy mission is slightly different. Rather than focusing on specific projects or resolution of situations, the Office is concerned with the higher-level overarching policies that affect long-term sustainability of Oregon's rural communities collectively and in the future. An example of that, after hearing water issues in virtually every corner of the state, in almost every town hall that we've had in the last couple of years, Our advisory committee asked the governor to consider the need for long-range water planning. The Water Supply and Conservation Initiative was included in the governor's budget, in the Oregon Department of Water Resources budget. In addition, as you heard earlier, the Office of Rural Policy also works with a grant from U.S. Department of Interior Economic Development Administration. We received a federal grant for 2 years in a row, and it's each grant is kind of a project with a different purpose, and the purpose of this particular grant is to investigate the needs and issues that Senator Johnson was talking about, and to find better ways to deliver that program, and to find out what's left of the list from 2003-2004. And so the bulk of the office efforts really have been around servicing both the grants and rural communities in terms of unraveling many layers of complexities that have ultimately led Oregon rural communities to suffer the substantial job loss and in its rural communities.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions. Just to establish my bona fides to have an opinion on this, when I was in the House, I was appointed to the Rural Policy Group right after it was created. And then when I matriculated to the Senate, I left that position. When I took a substantial cut in rank and moved to the Senate.
Thank you.
Couple of questions. The first one is, how now are you defining rural? Because I think there's a perception that the activities of this office are confined to those communities on the other side of the mountains. How are you defining rural?
Well, depending on the subject, rural is defined differently by different jurisdictions. The Office of Rural Health, for example, has federal guidelines for health that are based on population and distance. And the Office of Rural Policy has four definitions of rural, also based on population and distance, but they might not all be the same. Generally speaking, the coast is a major part of rural because it has some of the same issues as eastern Oregon. And so for the most part, the census is now categorizing counties by metro and non-metro. And so the main urban counties of Multnomah, Lane, Marion, and Jackson, I think, are your metro areas.
I know there's a pony in there somewhere, Jim. What's rural?
You know, rural is, I guess the bottom line is you get out of town, and the population things really don't, as a practical matter, they really don't work because some of the population formulas include Lake Oswego, for example. So we have to use discretionary judgment to define beyond population and look at communities that are somewhat distressed and rural. And then if you talk about distress, then you're also talking about North Portland. So
funny, distressed and rural and Lake Oswego don't quite all hook together for
right.
me. Mr. Chair, here's my real question. You discussed, when you were at your high-level overview, focus on health and water issues. And I'm trying to figure out what it is about the Office of Rural Policy that confers any degree of expertise on you to deal with this issue, other than these issues, other than being a forum for local anecdotal input. We have health agencies, DHS, DQ, that deals with these sorts of things. We have a whole agency that deals with water. I cannot think of a more controversial, contentious, complex, fraught with legal difficulties issue than water. Many of us are of the opinion that water is going to be the next great battleground in Oregon. Why does this office have any expertise to weigh in on those subjects at all?
This office and the advisory committee really doesn't have the capacity to complete the research and the findings that would formulate the kind of policy that you're talking about. The overarching concept means just exactly that, that when we go around the state and we listen to communities talking in every corner of the state, even in the Willamette Valley, recently I was in a meeting with small cities at Lafayette and Carlton and McMinnville and Forest Grove, they have water problems too, and it's not just from being rural adjacent to metro, it's just from the fact that the metro population is growing and growing outside of the city, and the design of the systems doesn't have that capacity. So we can take a look at the existing policies and practices, for example, and coordinate with Phil Ward at Water Resources and ask the question, what are we doing in long-range water planning? We're not going to do the long-range water planning ourselves, but we would suggest to that committee and that commission that long-range water planning is essential.
But, Jim, do I need to spend $390,000 to ask what, in my opinion, is an obvious question? What are we going to do about water in this state? I guess I'm trying to figure out what are the deliverables out of this office. You've been in existence now by executive order for in your fourth year. What are the deliverables?
I think the deliverables are also to find out areas of rural communities that there are a lot of problems out there in terms of the population, the unemployment, the migration. There are a lot of unanswered questions. We're convening a group of the universities, for example, to find out to develop research concepts around some of the questions that we don't know the answers to.
Give me an example.
For example, in housing, housing is not a new challenge, but there are areas of housing that really don't fit the Oregon affordable housing and workforce housing formulas. And so we're asking the universities to take a look at the unusual, unique differences in rural per capita wages as compared to the price of housing. Currently, the federal guidelines and formulas don't include the cost of houses as they're sold. And so right now, the phenomenon in rural Oregon with the in-migration, the people moving in are elevating the price of real estate. And so it doesn't work with the formulas, and so we're going to have a major housing problem. So if we fund housing, we want to have a formula that would distribute the money most effectively.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to just pound on this, Jim, but your discussion paper is after the fact of the policy that's already making it through this building. If everything goes the way that I think some folks anticipate, Senate Bill 38 passes, and we make a $100 million investment in housing. And I think for any of us that live along the coast, I could tell you what the pressures are on housing. I mean, we've got raw land for $800,000 in gated communities that are forcing the people that provide services, teachers, firemen, policemen, they can't live in Pacific City anymore. They have to live in Hebo and commute. I'm trying to figure out how the exercise of this office is informing policy. What do I have as the result of the existence of this office for 4 years that has instructed me as a policymaker representing a rural area with respect to my work here in this building?
Senator, one of the advantages of being chair is you can wait to say anything and tell everybody else has spoken. And that way you save yourself the risk of looking dumb by asking stupid questions or looking brilliant.
Let us do it.
Or looking brilliant because other members of the committee are discussing the questions that you want to bring forth. And it is precisely the agenda that you have that concerns me. And there's, with no disrespect to Jim and the work that he's been doing, but I'm absolutely flabbergasted that it is 2007, and for the first time in the decade plus that I've been in this building, somebody in the governor's office has recognized is beginning to recognize that we have a water problem in the state of Oregon. Because in the 10 years that I've been in this building, I've been talking about the water problem as it relates to my district and to Eastern Oregon. Memory now has it that the good representative on my left, while mayor of the city of Wilsonville, had a major problem with water for his city, located here in the Willamette Valley, where you get more water than Carter's got little liver pills. And now, you know, in spite of having had numerous legislative activity, my predecessor, Representative Norris, spent an incredible amount of time and energy in this issue of water. And compliments of Representative Norris and the representative or senator from the coast, Senator, her name's escaping me, and that's terrible. You know, there was a Senate Bill 93, I believe, memory serves me, a task force to look at this issue. Spent 2 years examining and looking at and discussing the water issues, and only to have those things now rediscovered 10 years later, when nothing has been able to, you know, get any traction in the executive department to move anything to deal with the problems that have been already identified. And one of the things I see constantly happening, and lots of time, energy, and therefore I assume money going into looking for places to store water, the issue of water storage.
Too much gaiety.
Somewhere in the world, you know. And so I'm having, you know, a little bit of the same concerns, I think, that Senator Johnson is bringing up. And I know we're approaching the end of the hour, and we do have floor session at 10 o'clock, and we'll leave you with those things to contemplate before we come back on Monday. We're going to continue the hearing on Monday and go from there with it. We will be canceling the work session that was scheduled for Monday, colleague, but that will be postponed for a little while. And I know you want to respond, Jim, but can we do this Monday, please? With that, we're adjourned.